The second assignment is up online as well. I got that up yesterday, so if you're anxious to keep progressing, you can start working on that one as too. Classical conditioning stuff there, so the next one's on classical conditioning. Same place, same page, go to the assignment page. Work your way through. Alrighty, now, I haven't really said anything about particularly how we're going to actually arrange, how we're going to sequence our conditional stimuli and unconditional stimuli. I've just said things like, so, you know, we present a conditional stimulus and it gets associated with a unconditional stimulus. Okay. Is there more, Dr. Snyder? Yes, there is. In fact, there are five different ways that we might present or sequence our conditional stimulus with our unconditional stimulus. First of these is called shortly. Now, your textbook only talks about four. I'm going to give you the full five, okay? So, short delay. Okay, if we're presenting this here, there's our little graph going on. Time is going, conditional stimulus has been presented, and sort of just shortly before, then their unconditional stimulus gets presented. All right. Short delay conditioning is going to be, all other things being equal, it will produce the strongest conditional response in the fewest number of trials. Like I said, all other things being equal, this is probably if you just have to produce a conditional response in some subject for some reason, probably go with this. Almost always it's going to be the fastest. Question, I suppose, is how long do you present the conditional stimulus before the unconditional stimulus? And this depends a little bit. If you're dealing with, say, a simple autonomic response, so an endocrine response or digestive response, some of that, maybe your CS is on for anywhere from 5 to 30 seconds before the US occurs. If it's a quick skeletal response, like an eye blink or something, you may only need half a second of CS before the US occurs. Now, why is it called short delay? It has nothing to do with the overlap between the US and the CS. In fact, different people do short delay conditioning in slightly different ways. In one way that people do it is you turn your CS on, you present your CS, and then you sort of second or two before your CS is turned off, is terminated, you present the US. Alternatively, others do this as you present your CS is going, and as the CS is being terminated, that's when you present the US. So the delay means there is a delay between the time in which the CS begins and the presentation of the US. And it's relatively short. Like I said, anywhere from like half a second to maybe up to 30 seconds in some cases. So that's a short delay. There is only a short delay in time between the initiation of the CS and the initiation of the US. And you go, 30 seconds, that's kind of long, isn't it? It's kind of relative, right? So let me... It doesn't, here's the other thing. I think your text really talks about only in one particular way, but it literally doesn't matter if there's a brief overlap between the CS and the US. So if the CS is still going for a little bit of time, second, two, three, before the US, or while the US is going, it's still short delay. If the CS terminates just as the US is kicking in, short delay. The issue is the time before the US is presented. Let's contrast this with what's called long delay. In long delay, we are going to present the conditional stimulus for a long period of time before the US is initiated. How long? 30, 40, 50 seconds, minutes, potentially hours. All right? So, just to kind of compare the little chart from the last one here. So we turn the CS on, a whole bunch of time passes, and then eventually the unconditional stimulus is presented. Now, this is, again, all other things being equal, generally going to be a harder way to produce a conditional response. It will probably require many more trials to get that. You may never get the conditional response to the same level. You may get into some other problems. So let's say we're going to present our conditional stimulus for 5 minutes before our US initiates. In that 5 minutes, so it's like, okay, we're going to use a tone. How long can I do this is the question. I cannot do it for 5 minutes. Okay, but so our tone is going to go for 5 minutes. Well, clunk. That door just went clunk behind us. If just randomly somebody clunks the door 10 seconds before the US is presented, what do you think the subject's going to make an association with? What happened just shortly before the U.S. was presented? Oh, a door went clunk. Maybe that's the CS. It's not the one you intended, but that's actually it. Maybe the researcher's got a bit of a cough or has a nervous habit of tapping on the desk. If that happened, you got the CS going for 5 minutes, but if one of those desk taps happens to coincide just before the U.S. is presented, might be more likely to make that association. It's not the association that's intended. Okay? So there could be some other non-relevant stimulus that serves as a distraction. Hey, here's another one. The subject has to actually be able to do a time estimation. We've been talking a lot about things like salivation, right? What's the purpose of salivation? Salivation helps digestion. Now, let's just say that you figured this out. Let's say you figured out that this tone means that you will get some food. Should you start salivating when you first hear the tone? You got 5 minutes before the food's showing up. You could have a whole bowl of a meal, right? And, you know, let's imagine you're out on a date. That's not very attractive, right? The waiter comes by and says, your dinner will be out in just a couple of minutes. So you start salivating. Your date's like, what's wrong? Well, it's way for food. And it's... Yeah, exactly. That facial expression is exactly how that date would run. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, nice. Somebody out in the audience had this. It's like, yeah. Right, the second date, no, not going to happen. So, you need to sort of be able to go, I really don't need to start salivating until maybe, 4 minutes and 55 seconds are up. Now, watches are a relatively recent invention. Clocks. Even going back 500 years, a clock could take up half the size of this room. Okay? You're not pulling that around with you on your date. And what are you going to do? You're going to sit there? Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, 4 Mississippi. Your date's talking to you. 5 Mississippi, 6. What? 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. Or you can just kind of try to wing it. It's like, I think it's been 5 minutes now. Start salivating. Too soon. Oh, the food's here. Darn, I missed it. Now my mouth is dry. We actually can estimate time without clocks and watches and whatnot, but there's a measure, there's a bit of error there. It's harder to do, okay? If it's short delay, you don't really have to do much in terms of temporal estimation. It's like it's just a few seconds. It's like, hey, there's the CS, and I should probably get going with my conditional response on this one. Yep, and there's the US. Wonderful. Okay. So long delay, a bit harder. Again, whether or not there's sort of a measurable overlap between the CS and the US, or whether the US is presented as the CS is terminating, meh, no biggie. Again, the issue here in delay is the delay between the onset of the CS and the onset of the US. Trace conditioning. Trace conditioning, old term, comes from memory trace. Going back into, psychologists love to use technology sort of metaphors. In tabula rasa, the idea your mind is a blank slate. So when chalkboards were like high tech, it's like yes, your brain is like a chalkboard. Imagine it that way. Okay. When computers started coming in, cognitive psychologists, it's like your brain is like a computer. You have memory and input and output, short-term buffering system. Okay. Nowadays, your brain is kind of like an iPad. We use new metaphors. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, what was kind of snazzy, high-tech for making copies of things was tracing paper, or also if you're using a typewriter, called carbon paper. So the idea is your brain was like a typewriter with carbon paper. So it experiences something tick, 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 on the typewriter, and the carbon paper has been slipped in, and so it makes a duplicate and files that somewhere. So memories are like tracing paper or carbon paper. So this is why it's called trace conditioning, from memory trace. Okay, so the memory is a tracing of real events. Or you can just go, it's just a weird name for it. I don't care why. That's fine. I don't care. Either way, just remember, trace conditioning. In trace conditioning, the CS is presented. The CS stops. Some time passes. Then the US is presented. The time that passes between the termination of the CS and the onset of the US is called the trace interval. Now, we get into some of the same issues here that we had in long delay conditioning. Right? Other stimuli may occur in that trace interval. There could be a car backfires outside just before the US is presented. Oh, that must be the thing that I'm supposed to make an association with. Nope, that was just random. Again, we still have to have time estimation involved here. Okay. So we get into some of these same problems. We have to remember that the CS occurred. You even just got to remember what the CS was. Beep. Was there something that happened 30 seconds ago? I can't remember what it was. It was sort of a sound, wasn't it? It was kind of a You got to remember it, okay? I mean, you guys probably remember the beep sort of thing, but I mean, this might be difficult. What if then you hear a onk? Was that the same thing as a beep? Are they similar? Are they different? You get into generalization discrimination. Okay, this is becoming more common. So again, it's harder. Short delay conditioning, still probably the easiest one so far. Okay, so there's our trace interval. Simultaneous. Simultaneous conditioning, the CS and the US are presented simultaneously. So they both onset and both terminate at pretty much the same time. Now again, this is weaker, it's going to usually produce weaker conditioning than short delay. If we think about probably the real value in classical conditioning, its real value is probably predictive, right? Ring the bell, a few seconds later, food is put in the dog's mouth. The bell lets the dog know food is coming. The bell says, hey, you know what? I could wait until the food hits my mouth and start salivating then, but why don't I get a little bit of a head start on it? Just a little more saliva ready to go. Or I ever tried to you got a dry mouth and stuff, rice cakes or saltine crackers into your mouth, crumbs, that kind of thing. You never tried this. You people just haven't lived. I live online! Okay, great. Go get a virtual cracker and try this out in simulation. All right, so maybe a little bit of saliva makes it a little bit easier for you, okay? Well, or what if it's like, oh yeah, that tone indicates the shock is going to be coming. So maybe I should tense up that shock so it won't hurt as much, right? Okay, so predictive, or the puff of air, beep. Oh, yeah, air puff's coming. I guess I could close my eye so I don't have, right? What if the air puff and the beep are together? I can't do it, right? I need somebody else to beep. Okay, but you get the idea, right? Beep. It's like, wow, thanks for that warning. I've already just been smacked in the eye with something. Yay, useless. Beep. leave with food in the mouth. Hey, thanks for letting me have that advanced. You know, it's like, beep shock. Yeah, good warning on that one. Yeah, no warning at all. And it's not predictive. Subjects will eventually learn about this. Like, yeah, they go together. But since it's not terribly helpful, it's not something they tend to focus on very much. All right, last one, fifth one here. Backwards conditioning. In this case, we do something a little bit peculiar. We present the unconditional stimulus first, then the CS. So, bzzz, with the shock, beep, yay. Right? So, you know, or here's some food. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. Not terribly useful. You know, the old sort of cowboy motif, the triangle, clang, 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 come and get it. What if, you know, what if the cook puts all the food out, you know, and kind of 15 minutes later goes, oh, yeah, I should call people in. Ka-clang, ka-clang. By which point, I don't know, the cows have eaten it or something. Wolves, a grizzly bear, wrestlers, I don't know. Where's all the food, Cookie? Oh, no, it's been sitting out for 15 minutes. Why didn't you ring the bell first? Oh, never thought of that. Okay, so backwards conditioning, not very predictive. As such, in most cases, you don't tend to learn about it. In fact, there have been some studies, not all, but there have been some studies that show that if you set up backwards conditioning, the CS actually becomes a CS minus. It says, hey, what have I learned? In the presence of the CS, I'm not going to get the US. So in some studies, for example, again, not all, but in some studies where shock is the unconditional stimulus, kind of stressful. You don't know when you're going to get shocked, right? Bzz, zap, you got shocked. But if you've got a beep for 30 seconds, if it's backwards conditioning, you've learned, oh, at least when the beep is going, I'm not getting shocked. Whew, I can relax then. The beep indicates no shock. Again, not all cases, not all studies have produced the same results. Backwards conditioning leads to a lot of variation. In fact, there was actually one study by Keith Lucas and Gutman that, I think the 70s, demonstrated that you could actually get really strong conditioning, backwards conditioning. Here's what they did. They had a rat in a cage. So the rat's there in the cage, and they've got some sugar pills, and rats like sweets. Nowadays, we actually, you know, the little M&Ms, the little tiny ones, the little baking M&Ms. Okay, it's great. That's just like a palm size for a rat snack. Okay, so the milk chocolate melts in their mouths, not on their paws. We used to use little baking chocolate chips, and that was a problem because they would melt. The rats eat them, so they've got like the chocolate's melting in their paws, and then they're drooling on it, and then they walk all over the equipment. And in my time, I have been a lab minion, and it's not fun to have to clean rat footprints off of all the equipment, little chocolatey, sticky, messy things mixed in with poop and other rat yickiness. Anyways, so the little M&Ms that are in the shell, it's a lot easier to work with. Okay, anyhow, so, you know, Keith Lucas got me used sugar pills back then, so got a rat goes, eats the sugar pills, quite happily eating the sugar pills. Then what they did, so once the rat's used to eating the sugar pills, getting sugar, they zap, they give the shock to the rat, turn the lights out for 10 seconds. Lights come back on. Sitting in the far corner of the cage is a toy hedgehog. One of these little squeaky toys for dogs. You might have seen them, little squeaky hedgehog. Dogs like to chew on them. Bum, bum, bum. Then what they do is check it out. So they get the rat eating the food. So the rat's eating the sugar pellets. And then they put the hedgehog into the cage. The rat stops eating the food. Keeps staring at the hedgehog. Odd, no? The hedgehog is our CS. Okay, the shock is the US. Shock presented first. Lights go out for 10, 15 seconds. Lights come back on. Hedgehog is there. CS is not detected until after the US. But very strong conditioning. The hedgehog induces fear in the rat. The rat stops eating because you don't want to have your back turned to the hedgehog, right? Because maybe he's going to attack then, right? You don't want to have your head down stuffing your mouth with sugar because who knows what's going to happen at that point, right? Now, that's weird. Why does it work in that case? Keith Lucas Gutman said, you got to sort of think about this in a real-world situation. Imagine that you're not a rat. Imagine that you're an antelope on the plains of Serengeti, okay? You're nibbling away. You know, this is like a method acting sort of thing. So try to imagine that you're an antelope. Imagine the antelope. Be the antelope. Right. You're nibbling away at the grass. Suddenly, there's a searing pain in your butt. You leap away as only an antelope can. You look back and you see that there's claw marks on your haunch. And you look back behind you from where you came. And there's a lioness in the grass with blood on her claws. She fades back into the grass. Okay. Pain from being clawed. Pain, that's the US. Visual sight of the lioness. CS comes after. Now, if the antelopes, you know, if ancestral antelopes couldn't put two and two together, and get seven, no, four, okay, they would probably get it. And if they didn't make the connection, I think that lion is the thing that caused my butt to hurt. And it's like, oh, a lion. Maybe it'll be friends with me. Those antelopes get eaten pretty quickly. So, in some circumstances, backwards conditioning actually works really, really well. Okay? But in most, it probably doesn't. So, that's it. All other things being equal, probably if you just have to set up classical conditioning, probably you want to go with short delay conditioning. Okay. I sometimes get people say, so why the heck does anyone bother with all these other types? Because you can. Because theoretically it's interesting. Because practically in the real world, you don't always get short delay conditioning. Well, in the real world, you may have long delay, or you may have trace delay, right? Dinner! People come upstairs, you know, come up from the basement, whatever. It's like, where's food? Oh, it's not quite done yet, actually. Sorry. Few minutes. You know, stove's on fire, something's happening. Set up, deal with this quickly. Okay. So you may get trace conditioning in the real world. So those are reasons for you know, studying this. Okay. Let's take a look at some other factors that influence classical conditioning. Contiguity. So CSUS contiguity. We've really been talking about this here in terms of the temporal structure. Technically, contiguity refers to closeness together in time and or space. But honestly, in terms of classical conditioning, the space thing is pretty much irrelevant, right? I mean, if there's a beep, a buzzer ringing on the other side of the planet, and then food gets put in your mouth, I mean, you're not learning anything about that, okay? So CS and US have to be in pretty close physical proximity in all classical conditioning situations anyhow. So when we're talking about contiguity in terms of classical conditioning, we're really talking about temporal contiguity, okay? So generally speaking, and this is what we've just been talking about here, the closer together in time the CS and the US are, easier it's going to be to produce that association to get the conditioning. Now, depending on the type of conditioning we're dealing with, this may be a little different. So in terms of eye blink, the contiguity needs to be pretty close. Snap, pretty close together in time. If you did snap, 3 minutes later, come back, go, what the hell is that for, you jerk? No, I'm doing science. Fine. What is that for, jerk scientist? Taste aversion, though. Excellent monkey brain sushi. 6 hours later, blah! Still a pretty strong association. Curse you, monkey brain sushi! Okay, so in that case, you know, trace conditioning, really strong. So the specifics sometimes come into play here. Contingency, CSUS contingency. A contingency is an if-then situation. In mathematic speak, we might say something like X, IFF, Y. X if and only if Y. Okay, so event X will occur if and only if event Y occurs. In classical conditioning, this involves the consistency with which you set up your CSUS association. So a strong contingency would be the US will occur if and only if the CS has occurred prior to it. That's a strong contingency. Every time the CS occurs, the US follows it, that's going to lead to very strong, going to produce a very strong CS plus, an excitatory conditional stimulus. What if, you know, whoever's delivering the US is sometimes a little bit lazy, doesn't pay attention to it, or we've actually set it up this way on purpose, so only half the time the CS is presented is it followed by the US. Well, that's going to produce a weaker association. Because you don't really know, right? Half the time the bell rings and I get some food, but the other half the bell rings and nothing happens. Should I really be bothering to salivate right now or not? Okay, so the greater the contingency, the consistency, the stronger the association. Even if you've got a CS minus, an inhibitory, if you know every time there's so in the presence of a green light, you're going to get shocked. In the presence of a red light, you will not get shocked. So then if we pair the green light and the red light together, and we've got an inhibitory conditional stimulus, that would say, no, we're not going to get shocked even in the presence of the green light when the red light's there. What if, though, you know, the red light's only saying you won't get shocked maybe 50% of the time? Green light means, yeah, you're going to get shocked. Red light means, yeah, you may or may not. Not a really useful inhibitory conditional stimulus, right? So whether or not you're dealing with excitatory or inhibitory conditional stimuli, contingencies, very important. We will also see, when we get into operant conditioning, contingencies, very significant there as well, especially in the field of punishment. Okay? So all other things being equal, the greater the contingency, the quicker, the easier, the stronger the learning is going to be. Features about the various stimuli involved. What you're dealing with may actually influence what kind of learning you're going to get. This could be the intensity or the novelty even of the stimulus. Generally speaking, up to a point, more intense generally up to a point, the more intense the stimulus is, the more salient it is. And by salient, we mean the more detectable. So, as opposed to beep. Okay, so a quiet beep, not that noticeable, not that salient. Beep, louder, more intense, more salient. What if I pulled out a foghorn and blasted you with the foghorn in here? Well, that would be a very intense stimulus. And after you're treated for your ruptured eardrums, blood leaking out, that would be... The intensity is so high that the salience actually becomes very low, right? Because we just ruptured your eardrums. Okay, but generally speaking, as long as we're not exceeding some, you know, danger critical level, the more intense your stimulus is, the more salient it is, the easier it is to attend to it, the easier it is to make that association between the CS and the US. Similarly, in terms of unconditional stimuli, if it's a very tiny, small piece of food, I've just put 6 molecules of meat powder into your mouth. I've just put 30 grams of meat powder into your mouth. Which are you more likely to notice? Wow, 6 molecules of meat. Yay. Need a mass spectrometer for that one. Thank you very much. Okay. Novelty. If you've never learned anything about a stimulus before, especially something you want to turn into a conditional stimulus, it's going to be easier to make that association. Remember we talked about if we set a stimulus up as a CS minus, and then we want to try to turn it into a CS plus, it's going to take more trials. It's going to be harder. This is why generally in, say, laboratory studies, we try to pick stimuli that are neutral, that the subjects have not been exposed to before. In the real world, this is more difficult. Okay. So, compound stimuli. Briefly encountered this already here. Compound stimulus is a case where two or more stimuli are presented together. Okay? And in classical conditioning, we almost always, and for our purposes, this is what we're going to deal with, are going to be talking about two or more conditional stimuli. Okay? You can do things where you present two or more unconditional stimuli together, but let's not worry about that right now. You've got two or more simple stimuli that we're going to set up as conditional stimuli. They get paired with your US. Or they just get presented together by themselves. Okay. So that's a compound stimuli. Now we get into all kinds of interesting things when we start playing around with compound stimuli. One of the things we get into is overshadowing. I already just talked to you a couple minutes back about salience and salience effects. Imagine you've got a tuba, and a fife. That's kind of like a type of flute or a quarter, right? Ba-oom! If we present those two things together, ba-oom! I mean, which are you more likely to hear? The tuba probably overwhelms the fife. If we've got a really intense light and a quiet tone, might be more likely to attend to, at least if you're humans, attend to the very intense light. If you're a rat, maybe it's a little bit different. Maybe the auditory is more significant. These things can vary a little bit. But generally, if you've got two or more stimuli together, the more salient stimulus is the one that will produce that will make the strongest association with the unconditional stimulus. So if you've got a light and a tone, you're going to present these together and then follow them, say, let's just do short delay conditioning with the unconditional stimulus. If it's a highly salient light and a low salient tone, then if you test the light by itself, let's do some test trials, present the light, we see what kind of conditional response we get. We present the tone, we see what kind of conditional response we get. Probably going to find that we get a pretty strong conditional response for the light, and a somewhat weak conditional response for the tone. The more salient stimulus produces the stronger conditional response. Okay? Latent inhibition. In latent inhibition, we repeatedly present a neutral stimulus. We're just going to label this as in here. Okay? So, just be a tone. Beep, 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 beep. We're not presenting an unconditional stimulus at this point. So let's present this tone 20 times. Now, let's take and pair this tone up with an unconditional stimulus. Beep, food in the mouth. Beep, food in the mouth. Beep, food in the mouth. All right. So there's like one group of subjects we've done this with. We presented the tone a number of times. Then we pair the tone with the unconditional stimulus. Let's take a second group, our control group, and let's just start from the very beginning, tone paired with the unconditional stimulus. What we're going to find is in our first group, the one that's had the tone presented 20 times by itself, it's going to be harder to condition that tone as an excitatory conditional stimulus. It will take many more trials to get the same strength of CR as we've gotten with the second group, our control group, where we just go tone and food right from the very beginning. Okay? It's called latent inhibition. Now, why? Why is this happening? There's two possibilities here. One is that by presenting the tone by itself a whole bunch of times. In other words, the tone is being presented without the unconditional stimulus. We are, in fact, turning it into a CS minus, an inhibitory conditional stimulus. Every time I hear the tone, I don't get anything. I have learned tone means nothing happens. Okay. So that's one possibility. And then when we start pairing the tone with this, the unconditional stimulus, we have to essentially extinguish the effect of the CS minus and now turn it into a CS plus. Second possibility is that we've had a habituation effect occurring. So by presenting the tone multiple times with nothing happening, we just habituate to it, and any sort of response that may have occurred drops off, nothing happens, and then we've got to deal with that when we try to set it up as an excitatory conditional stimulus. Okay. So both of these have been suggested. How could you test? So let's pitch this out. Can anyone think of a way that you could determine whether or not you've got a CS minus or a habituation effect going on? Okay, sorry. How? So we could have, what might have happened is by presenting the neutral stimulus, our tone, a bunch of times on its own, we may have actually trained the animal to think this is a CS minus. Tone means nothing is going to happen. Or it could be that, think back to habituation, just by presenting a stimulus multiple times where nothing happens, any sort of response to it, a startle response, anything at all, just wears off, our nervous system habituates, response is decreased. Yep?
You can just remove the tone altogether for a certain period of time, then we introduce it to see if it elicits a response.
Okay, and what would that tell us, and why? Right, because the habituation is going to wear off. Right, so if we just let some time pass, if we just let time pass here, habituation will wear off with the passage of time. So then we will have nothing going on. So if we do our present the tone a number of times on its own, and then we don't do anything for an hour, and then pair the tone with the US, if it's habituation, we're probably not going to have our experimental group any different from our control group. But because CS minuses, because classical conditioning does not just wear off with time, unless we're getting into forgetting effects, that's a little bit different, it's not going to wear off just with the passage of time, we could say that's due to CS minus. Good, yeah. Exactly right. Blocking. Okay. In blocking, we take and set up a first-order classical conditioning situation. We pair a CS1 with the unconditional stimulus. CS1, US, CS1, US, CS1, US. Do that. So we get a nice, strong conditional response to our CS1. Now, we're going to say, oh, darn, or maybe, hey, wouldn't it be cool? Oh, darn, I forgot I was supposed to do a compound stimulus. I'll toss it in. Or you may go, oh, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we turn this into a compound stimulus instead? Either you forgot or you've decided you want to do this, whatever. So now we take our CS1 and we add in a novel stimulus. We're going to call it our CS2. Now we do CS1 and CS2 together and the U.S. CS1 and CS2 and the U.S., this is not the same thing as higher order conditioning. Okay, keep in mind, blocking is not higher order conditioning. In higher order conditioning, it's CS1 plus the US, CS1 paired with the US, and then CS2 paired with the CS1. No US. Okay, I only mention this because past experiences show this is a common point of students going and making a mistake on exams. Okay, so they are different. In blocking, CS1 paired with US. We do this for a number of trials. Then we say, hey, let's make a compound conditional stimulus. CS1 and CS2 paired with the US. Do this for a whole bunch of trials. Let's test. Present the CS1 by itself, strong conditional response. Present the CS2 by itself, no conditional response or a very weak one. What we say is the CS1 has blocked learning about the CS2 or has blocked the association of the CS2. Okay. Now, there is, horror of horrors, an error in your textbook. Page 77. It says, blah, 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 background stuff, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. But suppose we eat two foods, one spicy and the other bland. If we then become sick, thanks to blocking, we are likely to develop an aversion to the spicy food, even though it may have been the bland food that caused our illness. Excuse me. What's wrong with this? The stuff we've just, the last few minutes we've talked about stuff. Yeah. Could be latent inhibition if we've been exposed to the spicy or the bland food a whole bunch of times before, maybe. So that's definitely possible. Yeah, we could set it up that way and get into this problem. I haven't given you a whole backstory on this one. It's in the textbook. But from all we can tell here, we've just got these two foods that we're presented with, one spicy and the other bland. Yeah, I think overshadowed. Just given what we've got here, I quite agree. With latent inhibition, we could say if you're used to eating bland foods more, and most people are, right, in you know, a Western, boring Canadian food culture, coming out of Northern European techniques where they had salt and not much else, yes, that would probably fit. But let's assume that we've been exposed to these, as the text seems to be suggesting, for kind of the first time, spicy and bland. We're probably not dealing with blocking here at all. That doesn't make sense. We're probably dealing with overshadowing. We've got a highly salient spicy and a low salient bland food. What do you notice? You notice the spicy. Okay. Sure, it might have been the bland one that was packed with bacteria that, you know, E. coli that poisons you, but you don't make that connection. So yeah, this is an error in the textbook. Don't know how he managed to screw that one up. There it is. Okay. Sensory preconditioning. Here we take two neutral stimuli, a light and a tone. They've never been presented to our subject before, so we present them together repeatedly. Light and tone, light and tone, light and tone, light and tone, light and tone. Then we take one of them, pair it up with the unconditional stimulus. Light, food, light, food, light, food, light, food, light, food, light, food. Until we get a nice, strong conditional response. Now, test the tone. Just present the tone. You will almost certainly get a conditional response to the tone, even though the tone has never been associated directly with the food. We go light and tone, light and tone, light and tone. Light food, light food, light food. Test the tone. Okay? The tone has never been paired with the food. And the tone has never been paired with the light after we do the light food conditioning. But light and tone were paired up initially. So what have you learned? So even though we have no unconditional stimulus here yet, you're making an association. Light and tone go together. Light and tone go together. Light and tone go together. What goes together? Light and tone, yes, thank you. Somebody did, lovely. Most people just look at me like, okay, so nice. Okay, then we associate one with the U.S., even though our second one has never been associated with the U.S. or with our now CS that's been paired up with the U.S., we still get an association. So again, this is not higher order conditioning either. In the higher order, CS1 paired with the U.S., then our neutral stimulus, it's going to turn into a CS2, gets paired with the CS1. In this case here, we do the pairing of neutral stimuli first, turn one of them into a CS, and our second one that's never been paired up with the US produces a CR as well. This one is almost insulting to present to you as one of those effects on classical conditioning, but here it is. The more times you pair a CS with a US, the stronger the conditioning gets. Rocket science, no. This is more like, you know, a Charlie Sheen moment there. Winning. Yeah, you get your asymptotic curve, you know, there you, it's, right? I mean, it just, it's common sense. The more times you do something, the better you get at it. Up to some point. And this is where you get into these kind of learning curves, okay? So assuming we've got a lot of subjects involved here, we average the responses, you will start approaching what's called an asymptote. At some point, you will. There's really nothing more to learn. I mean, mathematically, technically, you can always still learn a little bit more. But for all practical intents and purposes, you're probably salivating as strong as you can possibly salivate, you know, at some time. All right? If we then went and changed something, so let's say, you know, Bell paired with 5 grams of food, you know, we do this so many times, after 20 times, you know, you're getting the same amount of salivation being produced every time. What if we then upped it? If we said, hey, we're going to now give you 10 grams of food, our learning curve would actually, boo, pop up again. We'd have probably a stronger conditional response there, okay? Because now we're getting stronger US. So we've changed something. But assuming everything stays the same, sooner or later we've pretty much maxed out our response. Typically it's a nonlinear process here, so we get this kind of curve towards the asymptote. ITIs, inter-trial intervals. This is the time between each CS-US pairing. Now, we talked earlier about the intra-trial timings, or intra, short delay, long delay, backwards, trace, simultaneous. Inter means we've got a CS-US pairing, some time then passes, and we do our next CS-US pairing. So that's the time that passes between these. Generally speaking, I mean, if you're just trying to set up a conditional response as quickly as possible, often an ITI of about 30-odd seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, something in there, is probably going to be pretty good. That probably, you'll probably, again, all the things being equal, be able to produce a conditional response fairly rapidly, doing it that way. So intertrial interval. If it's too long, I mean, you get into it and it's like, okay, we're going to do intertrial intervals of 6 days. This is going to take a long time for one reason, because obviously it's going to take you a lot longer to get through 20 trials. But second, you're going to get into forgetting effects. We will talk about forgetting much later in the course here, but just basically you forgot what was going on, so you get some decrement in your performance due to forgetting. So if you make it too long, you get into some of these forgetting effects. We talked a little bit about extinction earlier, just insofar as I said, this is what happens when we extinguish a conditional response, but I want to talk about it just a touch more here. So, yeah, just reminding you, conditional stimulus occurring without the unconditional stimulus leads to extinction. The weakening and probably ultimate cessation of your conditional response. Now, one of the important things here to recognize is that this is different from forgetting. Forgetting occurs just because of the passage of time. Well, that's not strictly true. Something's happening during that passage of time, but right now, let's just say that forgetting is a temporally relevant issue. Time passes. In the case of extinction, what we're doing is we're presenting the CS without the US. We have broken our contingency. So the contingency has been violated here. In fact, extinction is actually a form of learning. It is a new conditioning situation. So if tone, excuse me, if we do our initial conditioning that tone is followed by food, tone, food, tone, food, tone, food. Here's our contingency. In the presence of tone, food will follow. Now, tone, nothing, tone, nothing, no, tone, nothing. In the presence of tone, nothing will follow. That's a new contingency. Our subject hasn't forgotten the first contingency, at least unless a lot of time is passing here. Okay? But the extinction process, the cessation of the CR, is not because it's forgotten the first contingency, tone leads to food, but because it's learned a new one. Tone no longer leads to food. How do we know? Well, we can do what's called spontaneous recovery. So, tone, food, tone, food, tone, food, set it up as a excitatory conditional stimulus, slip it into extinction, tone, nothing, tone, nothing, tone, nothing, tone, nothing, until we have no conditioned response. Let some time pass, come back and test. Present the CS on its own, do a probe trial. No US here, just probe trial. We'll get a small return of the conditional response. A little bit of salivation there. What happens if you do a few more CSs? You know, it gets weaker, weaker, nothing. Come back sometime later, present the CS again, boop, a little bit of conditional response. If extinction completely eliminated what you had initially learned, you would not get a return in this conditional response. There would be nothing there. It would be like we actually had done a hard drive purge and wiped that out of your biological computer system. It would be gone. It's not. It's still in there. Okay? So, forgetting is wiping it out. If you forget, that has been eliminated. Or lost somehow. All right. Here's another way we can demonstrate this. We'll go through CS plus paired with the US. Do that. Go through extinction. CS plus by itself. No US. Now, let's say it took us 20 trials to get to, you know, pretty much asymptotic performance of our conditional response the first time around. Okay, we've now extinguished it. Let's see how many trials it takes to get back up to our asymptotic performance. Maybe it only takes 15 the second time around. Well, if it only takes 15, that means there's still something in there. It's not gone. That original learning is still stored in the brain. So if fewer trials are required, it's not gone. It hasn't been forgotten. It's still in there. You've just learned something else. Okay? All right. If you like pictures, here's a picture. Okay? Acquisition. Right, present the CS and the US, we get an increase in the strength of our conditional response. Here's extinction. Present the conditional stimulus by itself. So there's the extinction, CS presented alone, the CR weakens. Let some time pass, present the CS by itself, spontaneous recovery. A little bit of a conditional response that occurs. And reacquisition. Now, if we go back through presenting the CS in the US again, we'll see that it takes relatively fewer trials compared to our first acquisition to get back up to the same level of conditional response. Okay? So, graphical picture. A few minutes left here. I want to at least start here into the theories of classical conditioning. Okay? Not all of this is in your textbook, all right? Only some of it's in your textbook, but I think these are important things here. So I'm going to start with associationism. Go back a little bit in time. Associationism was always taught in psychology courses. It generally isn't taught that often anymore, which is unfortunate because it's actually a pretty easy way of figuring out why a lot of things happen the way they do, in especially learning. But also in areas of cognition. Basically, associationism is just the linking together of events, memories, actions, consequences, any of the, whatever you want to call it. Okay? If you go back in time to good old Aristotle, Aristotle was the first, well, sometimes people say, oh, Aristotle was the first associationist. Aristotle was the first person to write it down whose stuff was actually preserved over, you know, a few thousand years. Who knows? I mean, Thag Rock Smasher, you know, 15,000 years ago, might have been the first person to figure it out, but never wrote it down, so we don't know about that. Anyhow, Aristotle said, look, it seems that the kinds of things that people are easily able to remember are things that demonstrate either contiguity, so closeness together in time and or space, similarity, things that are more similar are easier to remember, or contrast, so contrasting pairs. And we find generally that these, even in the modern study of learning behavior, that Aristotle was pretty much spot on with this. Okay? So that we generate associations. So when we're talking about learning, what we are really doing is our brain is making associations. It's making connections. It's storing patterns. All right? Some things are easier to store as patterns. Other things are harder. But this idea of making associations is really core to the whole field of learning and behavior. Now, in terms of the modern field of psychology, we really see this coming into effect, being demonstrated beautifully by work by this guy, Ebbinghaus. Ebbinghaus, again, not a psychologist. All of the sort of many of the big names in the 19th century had nothing to do with psychology whatsoever. Ebbinghaus wasn't even a doctor. Ebbinghaus was just this guy who was single, and I mean, with the beard, you probably have the idea why, maybe. Had a lot of time on his hands to read, so he was reading stuff, and he started to this beginning field of psychology, the meaning of philosophy and physiology. That's kind of interesting. And so, and he'd read Aristotle's works. He was well-educated. So I think he said, well, it seems like we should be able to test this in people. Because Aristotle didn't test things. He just sort of said, I think it works like this. And everyone said, oh, yes, Aristotle, you're very smart. Let's go with that. Even if you're wrong, you're very smart. So let's go with that. Ebbinghaus said, I think we should probably test this. He wasn't at a university. He had like a day job in, I don't know, an office. So he'd come home at night, and he would, you know, in his home laboratory, would conduct scientific experiments. Kind of a, you know, got to picture this with like a Frankenstein castle and stuff, but really he just lived in a row house in Germany, so not nearly as grandiose. No lightning flashing, that sort of thing, but he'd carry out experiments. And he'd use, well, basically himself, because, you know, he just was doing this on himself, because he's not going to convince other people to come in and do this. So, well, here's what he did. He invented a whole bunch of nonsense syllables, like zog, path, pob, consonant, vowel, consonant. He picked syllables, invented syllables that meant nothing. They were not actual words. Okay? Dog, cat, those would be right out. Why? Because he's already got associations as to what those mean. I mean, zog, what's a zog? Ah, noun, verb, adjective, it's nothing. Okay? So he invents things that have no meaning. He'd then generate lists of nonsense, these nonsense syllables, and he'd read through the lists a number of times, and then he'd see if he could recite them from memory. And he'd keep going until he could recite them perfectly. Now, the measure he used is what he called savings. So if it took 10 trials initially for him to read his list, have it perfect recitation, and then he would wait some time. He'd let some time pass. And then let's say it would take 3 more trials to get him. So after some time passes, after a half hour passes, he's not getting it perfect anymore. His recitation is in error. So he has to go through 3 more rereadings of the list until he's back up to perfect recitation. He'd say he has a savings of 70%. So 10 minus 3 more trials needed divided by the initial total, 7 out of 10 or 70%. Other ways you could have done this, this is just how Ebbinghaus measured it. Didn't matter, he explained how he did it. It's a consistent measure here. He then takes and produces these graphs. So actually, some of the first learning curves, or in this case, actually forgetting curves, as the case may be, were being produced by Ebbinghaus. And these are now stunningly common in psychology. But he really produced them first. He found various things, like the length of the list. The longer the list was, the harder it is to remember, the more trials you will have to go through initially, and the worse your savings is going to be. Again, today this doesn't seem like rocket science, but he was the first one to actually empirically demonstrate this issue with respect to association of the complexity the amount of memory that you have to, details you have to store, makes it harder to make that association. Effects of repetition. He discovered overlearning. So he said, okay, it takes me 10 times to get this perfectly. If I don't stop there, but I do another 5 readings through the list, he would remember that list for longer than if he just stopped at 10. Instead of saying, yep, I've got it perfectly, I'm just going to stop. He said, go through it a few more times. You will hang on to this longer. So, in terms of studying for exams, you've read through your chapter the first time. It's like, you read through it a second time. A few things are still fuzzy. You read your chapter a third time. You've got it. Don't stop there. Read it another 2 or 3 times. Why? Because the final's a long ways off. The more you read it now, the easier it'll be to remember this stuff by the final. So you should probably read each of your chapters, or maybe 9, 10 Okay. Don't do that, right? But, I mean, that's the principle. And we're only in a 6-week course, so it's probably not that significant. But imagine you had a, nobody, they don't do year-long courses here anymore, I don't think, at the U of A. I think everything's down to like one term, but way in the past, a lot of universities give like full-year courses. You know, we're doing this over 8 months. Woo. Yeah, you might want to overlearn some of the stuff at the very beginning to hang on to it by the final. Right. So overlearning. The effects of time. Again, essentially forgetting. The longer time passes between your studying and you're having to recall, the worse you're going to be. So there's this forgetting curve. Contiguity, interestingly enough. He found that, yes, words that were learned in the list that were closer together, so zog, path, tog, it was easier to remember zog and path. So if you're given zog and said, what's the next word? Path was easier than saying, here's zog, what was the word to after that? That's harder. So the closer these are together, closer events are together, easier they are to remember, so contiguity. But he found that it only works in the forward. Just based on the principle of contiguity, zog, path, tor, okay, zog, path, tor, zog and path are as close together, they're as contiguous as path to zog. But if you read it, zog, path, tor, it's easier to say, here's zog, what's the next word? Path. It's harder to say, here's path, what's the word before it? Quick, what letter comes before Q? Okay, something wrong, right? What comes after Q? Easier. Okay? So the sequence you learn things in plays a role. So, associations. And we're done. Just I couldn't quite finish that off here, but we'll finish off this section next class. So have a happy day or so there, and we'll see you on Thursday.